When I learned that Canada would celebrate its 100th birthday with the World's Fair in 1967, I was very excited. With the opportunity to attend the fair with my Uncle Gib, who had designed one of the pavilions, it seemed too good to be true. First off, I had to get to Calgary, where Gib and his family lived. At the beginning of July, my parents drove me from our home in Sherman Oaks to the LA airport to catch the flight to Calgary, or they attempted to. The freeways were jammed, not uncommon in LA. Frustrated with that, my dad decided to enter the freeway from an exit. Thankfully, a cop stopped the car and asked why he was trying to kill himself and his family, as well as endangering oncoming traffic. He sheepishly turned the car around, and we waited in the traffic jam like everybody else.
Hey, very dangerous. Saw it once. I remember seeing once driving down the freeway. I saw a 56 Chevy. Yep. And a Cutlass.
Unsafe.
Crash.
No.
Unsafe. Oh, yeah, I saw that. Another time, I remember back in 1948, I was driving with my parents once, and I saw a Plymouth and a Ford crash.
Do it?
Oh, yeah, right.
Wipeout?
There were two or three people nearly killed.
Oh. Just the other
Several
day, the last day.
Don't put your finger in that box.
Oh,
there's
thank you.
There might
Careful,
be a spider
Peter.
In there.
You're right. There could be. I won't even look.
Yeah. Okay, the last day of our record, the day that we finally finished the record. I think we had 7 or 8 days during which we finally finished the record, which is wonderful. That very last day,
don't
I was...
Don't get your mouth too close to the microphone.
Oh,
you get a shock.
Oh, okay. No, that's all right. I'm not.
Don't get too close to me. I've got a cold.
I can
not,
see that.
Not,
I witnessed the aftermath of a crash. It had just occurred. I was going on Fountain towards Gower.
Oh, well.
And there were two modern cars completely demolished. The front ends were completely demolished. People were streaming out of the houses in the area as though, you know, they'd all heard
well,
this.
Well, they all wanted
to
see it, of course.
Right.
But, you know, they were all late.
Oh, yes, they were.
And
the drivers of the cars were getting out of the cars, and they were both about 70 years old. A 70-year-old woman with a great figure in pants, you know, and a blouse, and this old man
blind,
in a suit.
Both of them, probably.
Blind.
Blind. Driving cars totally
sure.
blind. They're well over 8,000
Well, you can see, though, if you can see it all.
Blind.
Yeah,
still. Can't see. They drive totally off of
sure.
noise and luck.
Right.
Most of them don't have an accident at all, you know.
I missed that particular flight, but caught the next one. From Calgary, I joined my uncle and his family and flew on to Montreal. The first thing I noticed in the city was the stop sign said arrêt instead of stop. Aha, a language lesson. The French I had supposedly learned in 8th grade, 3 years earlier, would be useful. Uncle Gib had designed the Canada Pavilion at the Brussels World's Fair in 1958 and won the competition to design the Western Canada Pavilion. Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta, and British Columbia put together to display their resources in an entertaining fashion. As you left the pavilion, they give you a brochure which reads, "In less than an hour, you have traveled from Manitoba through points in Saskatchewan and Alberta to locations in British Columbia in your tour through Western Canada Pavilion. During that time, you have had the opportunity to see just a few of the sources of wealth of that vast sweep of country and to enjoy your participation in the simulated development of those selected resources. The Western Canada Pavilion has been erected as a joint project of the governments of BC, Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba, and has cost approximately $1.3 million. Which is about the price of a lousy condo in Vancouver these days. It is some 12,000 square feet in area. Its roof reaches some 40 feet above street level. Towering above the roof line by some 20 feet are the tips of growing fir trees from the forest floor within. The shape of the roof line represents in cross-section the topography of Western Canada, with the flat sweep of the prairie, the rising foothills, and the tree-clad mountain slopes. Many of the components of the displays have been contributed by commercial and business firms throughout the West. Their involvement is gratefully acknowledged and their names listed. Your hostesses and guides in the pavilion are from Western Canada too, 4 from each of the 4 Western provinces. It is their hope, on behalf of their respective provinces, that you will not hesitate to write for more information on the area of interest to you. And then a description of the various displays. Pavilion visitors find themselves in a realistic Western farm scene as they progress through the agricultural display capsule toward the livestock section.
And in 1889, the Peace of Humus broke out, ending the Hundred Years' War against the cows.
Yep.
And the next one, research and development by private industry and government have played an important role in the growth of Western industry. Next, the immense logging truck is an overwhelming center of attraction in the forest scene as surrounding trees project their tops through the open roof. The mine, with its rocky walls embedded with representative samples of the West's many kinds of mineral riches, depicts Western Canada's underground wealth.
Coal, you say? Coal, did you say, Bill? You talking about coal? Hopefully the line of opposition to the strip mine machine will continue to stiffen. I mean, no one denies the benefits which coal has brought to a developing nation and a bustling economy.
True enough.
But if men are to find on this land the necessities of life hundreds of thousands of years from now, we must cure ourselves of the expediency complex.
The coal seam was 75 feet under the earth. At the mouth of the tunnel, the coal seam was raised on an angle facing the mountain. We drove the tunnel 100 feet and met the coal seam and faced up the coal. After we drove the tunnel 20 feet, the rock was hard as flint rock. We had to sharpen our old auger often. Sometimes it would take as much as 2 hours to drill one hole. We were going about 1 foot a day in the tunnel. The air was bad. There was no ventilation.
Canary's
we
dead.
Decided to blast one day and clean the loose rock out the following day. We had to get some air in the tunnel, so we bought several joints of black 2-inch pipe and screwed them together and pushed them into the
Great
tunnel. We pulled the blower off the blacksmith shop and attached it to the pipe and placed the blower 3 feet from the ground. All you had to do was turn the crank on the blower and pump air into the tunnel.
He tried to transmit his intellectual experience to his brother workers, but with discouraging results.
Ah, get out of here!
Once in the pit, he attempted to explain to them that the world was round, and he spun about vigorously on his feet to drive home his point. Ah!
He's crazy, Louis!
But the men laughed skeptically and declared that his information was absolutely untrue.
Henceforth, absolutely untrue.
George remained isolated in the spring of his expanding universe.
You know, mountains have been removed, and societies and psychologies destroyed, and surface excavations resembling vast moon craters with hundreds of feet of soil, Bill, and rock discarded in the assault to reach the coal have been left in massive piles.
The tipple set out in a little field. It was 40 feet higher than the drift mouth of the coal mine. To overcome gravity, we built a trestle from the coal tipple back to the ground level of the mountain and laid steel track down the trestle.
Bill.
Then we graded a tram road down the mountain to the drift mouth of the mine. We laid steel track down the incline to the drift mouth of the coal mine. We walked back up the mountain to the top of the grade, installed a hoist powered by a 1927 Chevrolet engine. The drive shaft was attached to the hoist. We hooked a steel cable in the mining car, put the old Chevrolet engine in low gear, and gave her the gas. The mining car climbed up the incline. When the mining car reached the top, we shut off the gas of the engine.
When I became aware that there were actually moonworms around the rocks, I'm afraid I temporarily lost my resistance, and that's when one of these parasites slipped into my head. They don't want to hurt anybody or anything. They just want to live inside others' heads.
Twice tragedy overtook him. Fanny Henderson, a farm servant who became his wife, died of consumption, leaving him with a young son. George's father was struck in the face by a blast of steam and lost his eyesight.
What a blast!
He retired from the pits, and George supported him for the remainder of his life.
You can put me down now, George. Coal, man, that's really interesting. Coal.
Energy moves by tube, and the energy capsule conforms to this shape as it displays impressions of the tremendous energy resources of the Western provinces. The wholesome odors of processing food and the glitter of moving cans enriches the atmosphere of the food processing section. The realistic fishing shed and the writhing net full of fish dripping from the side of the fishing boat testify to the importance of the fresh and saltwater fishing industry in the West. Products of Western Canada forest range from plywood to pulp, and from paper to timber, impressively displayed in this animated experience capsule. The way of life of Western Canada's greatest resource, its people, is presented in a three-screen theater. Because he was an insider, Uncle Geb and those accompanying him didn't have to wait in lines for the popular pavilions. What a wonderful thing to have such an uncle as a World's Fair guide.
We had, as the hostesses, we had a lot of interesting encounters with people from countries and pavilions that normally Israel would not have relations.
Interesting.
So
it created almost this neutral, politically neutral zone where people would interact that might not otherwise.
That's right. They were from Arab countries, from Muslim countries like Indonesia. And equally, we went because as a host and hostesses, we had access to many pavilions without lining up.
VIP.
We visited an awful lot of pavilions throughout Expo, very often going through the back door so that we don't have to stand in line. But also we created friendships and relationships with hosts and hostesses from other pavilions.
One of the longest lines was at the Czech Pavilion, which was full of wonders. Czechoslovakia's pavilion, a world of enchantment where art, technology, and industry are marvelously interwoven, was perhaps the most popular national pavilion at Expo. Its exhibits were sophisticated and presented brilliant and delightful audiovisual techniques where technology became art. Lines naturally were long, sometimes 2 or 3 hours. The pavilion's architecture was of supreme simplicity. Its walls were mainly of tinted glass on the ground level and a solid screen of ceramic panels above. While plain, the beauty was reserved for the objects on display within. Czechoslovakia, proud of its tradition, presented a breathtaking collection of ancient treasures in the Hall of Centuries, the first section of the exhibit. Here were gold and silver objects from the great Moravian Empire, 1,200 years ago, Romanesque frescoes, a replica of the ornate crown of St. Wenceslas, King of Bohemia, objects from the Gothic period, such as Madonnas carved in wood and a 15th century manuscript, and works from the Renaissance, Baroque, and more recent periods. In the Hall of Tradition, glass, crystal, and ceramics were featured. Examples ranged from centuries-old traditional to modern. In the World of Children section was a stunning display of puppets designed by artist Jerry Trinka. Here, puppet shows were presented with familiar tales of Grimm, Andersen, and La Fontaine. In the same area was the Trebechovice Bethlehem, an incredible wooden nativity scene with some 2,000 figures, 300 of them animated. It was carved by 2 humble craftsmen in Bohemia over a period of 40 years. A masterpiece of minute detail, it portrayed glimpses of everyday life in the 19th century. An exhibition of children's drawings further on brought a message of friendship from Czech children. Nearby was an extraordinary multimedia show called Diapoliokran, a grandiose interpretation of the creation. Spectators sat on a carpeted floor of a small auditorium behind a wall 32 feet wide by 20 feet high, making up 112 cubes, each 2 feet square. The cubes, each fitted with 2 slide projectors, glided backwards and forwards and changed pictures with split-second accuracy. The subject was cosmic evolution and industrial progress. The pictures were ever-changing, were multiple pictures that made a much larger image, split, then reassembled. Images flowed from volcanic chaos to green landscapes, from amoeba to insects to animals, from raw materials to gleaming machinery, from primate to Adam and Eve, and finally to modern man and his contemporary world. Another Czech subtheme was inspiration. Models displayed the latest creations of their country's fashion designers in daily shows. Around them were displays of elegant materials and exquisite lace, displays of gold and silver jewelry. Distressing modern problems of pollution and overpopulation were tackled in the next sub-theme, conflicts.
Men were going to deploy at 0800.
Check.
Recon all LOM sectors.
Check.
Bring up the 455s.
Pull.
Locate our fire perimeters.
Bonk.
Make a clean sweep. Flush out the enemy and...
The visitor entered a small hall where he saw how nature had been ruined by carelessness. The question asked was, how to achieve the most pleasant scene on the other side of the hall? Wide open spaces, clear flowing rivers, planned urban centers, and unspoiled countrysides. Models of water and air purification systems and models of an ideal suburb were presented. Kino Automat was an experimental theater where six times a day, groups of 127 spectators watched a 45-minute movie. As the cinematic tale unfolds, it poses a dilemma. Should he or shouldn't he? The film stops, lights go on, and the actor appears. The audience votes for the choice from buttons beside their seat, and computers tally the scores on boards on the side of the screen. The film proceeds according to the choice made by the collective audience. Choices are made five times during the unique show.
So here's your last deal, Miss Presky. Now, which would you rather do? Hit this Jew over the head with a bag of sugar or beat out that rhythm on a drum? Come on, love.
I'll take the bag.
You mean you're going to trade this 4-foot cube of 18-carat Swiss bullion and the snake knives, Mrs. Presky, all for that little bag?
Oh, yes, I want the bag.
Well, all right then, open it up.
Oh! Why, this is a bag of shit!
But it's really great shit, Mrs. Presky.
A line just as long stretched before The Labyrinth by the National Film Board of Canada. Like many of the flicks at the fair, it was multi-screen, with the pavilion designed around those changing perspectives. It's one movie from that flick dance fair that is online to view now. The NFB is funded by our tax dollars, so why not?
Enterin Labyrinth, home of the Kudzu Harvest Festival. Population, one more. Moose meat every Tuesday. Lions eat moose meat Wednesday. Optimists welcome. Pessimists say...
That's The Labyrinth at Big Red Ball's Red Ball Truck Cafe, home of the semi.
Listen to lovely Caleb in Kudzu County.
Labyrinth is one of the most ambitious of all the projects. It is an interpretation and consummation of Expo's unique theme program. The intention of The Labyrinth, prepared by the National Film Board of Canada, is to tell significantly in a 45-minute film the essential story of man. The Labyrinth Pavilion is in Cité de Havre, a short walk from Expo's main entrance. A dictionary definition of labyrinth is a place constructed of or full of intricate passageways and blind alleys. A Labyrinth at the Universal and International Exhibition of 1967 is a contemporary adaptation of the Minotaur legend of ancient Greece. The Minotaur was a monster, half bull and half man, living in a labyrinth. Each year, tribute was exacted of Athenian maidens and youths, whom the Minotaur devoured. Then the hero Theseus slew the Minotaur. Relating this idea to the theme of Expo, Man and His World, the filmmakers draw an analogy. As Theseus the hero advanced through the mysterious passageways of the labyrinth, so man throughout time has been exploring the planet Earth and his environment, from caveman to spaceman. The labyrinth is intended to bring the viewer intimate insight into the fundamental significance of man and his world. Man, the universal Theseus of the 1967 tale, performs his deeds in a remarkable theater of three chambers. Such physical innovations as use of flooring for the screen have made it essential that the theater be tailored to fit the film. Architecture became a significant factor as sight and sound. The pre-stressed concrete building of five stories can accommodate 720 people at a time. They will be distributed in groups through the three chambers, and at one stage will be surrounded by reflected images on all sides. At another point, they will gaze down from ramps on a huge screen 40 feet below and be subjected to sensations so strong that some will want to grip the handrail. Film for The Labyrinth has been specially shot by cameramen in many countries. There are no named stars to this movie. The dominant character is man. In the first long high chamber, spectators experience a sense of participation comparable to dropping out into space with the world left far below. In the second chamber, visitors move along walkways set between mirrored glass prisms. In the final chamber, the audience faces a multi-screen battery of unparalleled scope using five screens so that areas of the mind are exercised that almost have not been exercised before. If Theseus in this immensely expanded legend is man, what is the Minotaur? To visit Labyrinth will certainly be one of Expo 67's unforgettable highlights. Labyrinth have been associated with man from distant antiquity with his striving to bring significance and coherence to his existence. I still have my youth passport to Man and His World, Jeunesse, Youth. And looking inside, I find stamps from the various pavilions, the first one being Western Canada. One that particularly impressed me was the Canadian Pacific Cominco Pavilion. Canadian Pacific Cominco's 12-sided theater building featured a revolutionary 20-minute six-screen film in its 545-seat theater. The film, by Francis Thompson and Alexander Hammond, was a glorious multi-image tribute to youth. It attempted to follow the difficult road to maturity in a succession of spirited episodes.
Now then, Mr. Head.
Hi, Mr. Tirebiter. You know me.
Do you know the defendant?
Do I know Porgy?
And you spend all your free time with him?
Sure, except when he's in school.
So you don't go to school?
Heck no, I'm 30 years old.
Afterwards, people proceeded to a second building, which featured an exhibit 5 plus 1 about man's five senses.
Let's keep the lights out for this one, all right? If I do one, baby, one in five, no one here gets out alive now. You get yours, mama, I'll get mine. Gonna make it, baby, if we try, yeah.
The first room, dedicated to touch, had huge photographs that showed kissing, shaving, and other touch experiences. Then visitors attempted between identical-looking surfaces which were in fact rough or smooth, hot or cold, flat or curved. The taste area consisted of a machine dispensing flavored maple, mint, licorice, and coffee candy balls.
I want candy. I want candy.
What time are the other guys getting there? Everyone just said sundown, which should be soon.
I want candy. I want candy.
The sight area showed the role that shapes play in daily life, and in the sound area, recordings illustrated sound characteristics. Finally, for smell, metal cylinders like pipe organs emitted a variety of odors to identify.
A thing that stays in your mind, what permeated the odor that permeated Expo, I think, was Crisco.
Come on, Cisco.
Crisco? Oh, the Lord? The Lord?
Yeah, because so much of the fast food was fried food.
Its finale brought all five senses together in a presentation using 12 projectors that threw pictures onto a curved wall. They showed the role of the sponsoring companies in Canadian life. On the same page, which I guess I went to right after Western Canada, I also see stamps on the same page from Israel and the USSR, or the Soviet Union, as it was then called.
When we were living in the D.C. area, my family made two camping trips across the United States and Canada and back, from New York in 1964 and from Montreal in 1967. The fares were a great start to both journeys. My mother, who is now 100 years old, and I both remember Buckminster Fuller's Geodesic Dome, which was the United States Pavilion at Montreal, and the monorail ride, which went in and out of the dome. I also vividly remember the futuristic community called Habitat, which is actually occupied residentially to this day. If you've seen the Arthur C. Clarke movie, 2010, then you've seen Habitat. It was featured in the scene where David shows up on his widowed wife's TV to say goodbye before Jupiter turns into a star. Like the New York World's Fair in 1964, Expo 67 was a place of marvels, but there was a difference. Whereas the New York Fair was sponsored by corporations who displayed wonderful futuristic technology, the Montreal Fair was much more of a meeting of cultures from around the world. It had a very different feel from New York. It was the people of the world sharing their traditions and cultures with each other. It was the days of the Cold War, and I can't think of anything more necessary than having the USA and the USSR showing people who they really were, as opposed to all the propaganda being promulgated by both sides. I turned 13 that summer, and one moment which made a lasting impression on me was some Ukrainian girls about my age who were performing native folk dances. One of the girls smiled at me and I smiled back, and it suddenly occurred to me that these girls were really no different than my classmates back in the States. Maybe that was the whole point of the Montreal World's Fair, that the peoples of the world could come together and realize that the others were not monsters after all, and that we shared in common much more than we differed.
There were various sort of theme pavilions around Man and His World, Man and His Whatever. I've got stamps from Man and the Oceans, Man and the Polar Regions, a Labyrinth, which I just mentioned. Let's see, this is upside down. It says, the United States Pavilion.
That was during the Cold War. So the Russian Pavilion, the U.S. Pavilion had a lot of space stuff in it. The U.S. Pavilion was in a geodesic dome. That was pretty cool.
From Paul Krasner's autobiography, Confessions of a Raving, Unconfined Nut. True to its amorality, the Mafia had reportedly financed the printing of a poster showing the faces of Lyndon Johnson and Hubert Humphrey superimposed on the bodies of Peter Fonda and Dennis Hopper riding their motorcycles in Easy Rider. Now the Mafia was getting into the business of distributing LSD. A friend asked me to test a capsule, so I decided to take it at Expo in Montreal. I had been invited to speak at the Youth Pavilion, and also to give my impressions on Canadian TV of the United States Pavilion, a huge geodesic dome engineered by Buckminster Fuller. Before entering the United States Pavilion, which was guarded by Marines who had gone to protocol school, I ingested the acid. I began the CBC interview saying, "It's really beautiful with all these flowing colors. You don't see them, but I do." And ended up burning a photostat of my draft card. "Now the reason I'm doing this," I said, "is because we get hung up on symbols. People will be more upset about this than about the fact that children are being burned alive." The Marine lieutenant called his captain. When the interview was finished, the captain told me it was against the law to burn my draft card. So I took out my draft card and showed it to them. "But he burned it," the Marine insisted. "I saw him. He burned it." "I burned a photostat of my draft card," I explained. "So I lied on television. That's not a crime. People do it all the time." "It's also against the law to make a copy of your draft card," the captain said. Well, I destroyed the evidence. I knew that political demonstrations were barred at Expo, but I had managed to smuggle one in. The interview was labeled an incident, and there was a heated argument between the U.S. Information Agency and the CBC, but the incident was already on tape, so now it had become a free speech issue. It would be shown on TV that night, and become front-page news in Montreal papers the next day. Just as I was leaving the United States Pavilion, a band struck up a fanfare, and I made the mistake of projecting my own feelings, and suddenly I was convinced that LSD had been sprayed into the air, and everybody was tripping, that peace and love were breaking out all over the world at that very moment. As I was walking along, I started smiling at people and waving to them, and they were smiling and waving back. But then a core of reality came to the surface. the force of my own feedback made me turn around, and I saw those same people were now pointing at me. What an asshole. Still blushing, I found a phone booth and called up my friend in New York. Well, you can tell the mafia that I don't approve of their methods or their goals, but their acid is pretty powerful. It was the summer of love. The U.S. Pavilion featured a three-screen movie about kids playing. Of all the many films that I saw, that's the one I liked best, which is strange considering it wasn't nearly as spectacular as, for example, Labyrinth and some of the others, but it seemed to appeal to me more than any of the others. I also have a stamp for some reason from the Christian Pavilion. On the same page, Sweden, Iceland, Norway, Denmark, and Finland. I don't know if that was all one pavilion or not. And another one of those theme things, Man and His Planet and Space. No, Man, His Planet and Space. The next page, Britain at Expo 67 and Kaleidoscope, which I recall being quite spectacular.
We must see Kaleidoscope. And what's exciting is I think we're getting closer and closer. In looking at those patents that patent application, and suddenly looking at the sketches for the mirrors, because I always sort of took for granted that the projection on the mirrors were kind of, you know, did not play a huge role in the creation of the image. But no, the mirrors were sculptural and had been created in a particular kind of way. So I can't wait till that gets resurrected, and it must get resurrected.
Over here, there is the face of communism. Look at that.
Wow.
And see, you take that off.
And what do you see?
It's a mirror. I see myself.
Oh, my.
So Kaleidoscope is recognizable as the disc that had over 100 color fins on the outside that was essentially the color wheel, and it was sponsored by 6 chemical companies. And we had the amazing good fortune of being able to make contact and have conversations with Morley Markson, who was the designer of the films inside that pavilion.
He talked about being influenced by his mother's corner mirror upstairs, and it was a mirror that was divided in three. And as a young man, he started to experiment with fragmenting the image. So it's not just that it's an image cut in three; it's a reflection, and it was the reflection of the reflection of the reflection. And another huge influence on his thinking is Buckminster Fuller. And Bucky Fuller was hugely inspirational, and it was this sense of refractions and energy refractions inside of architecture. And so the screen for Morley was architectural, as it was for so many different filmmakers.
You never change things by fighting the existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete, says Buckminster Fuller. For all the talk of Buckminster Fuller at Expo, it was really McLuhan's fair, and that we were constantly being challenged to pay attention to how information was being presented to us on the screens and how this affected us.
You've been talking about the filmmakers of Expo 67 being very sensitive to the experience of the embodied spectator within these kind of spectacular architectures and projections.
I always say this to students, you know, you see things on YouTube and you think you've seen them, or, you know, some of my students are like, I don't go to the movies anymore because, you know, I have a big TV and I can watch the movies. And it's like, no, it's not the same film. It actually is not the same film. You know, it's a beautiful thing. And so that's why, you know, in seeing these multi-screen films was fascinating. I've seen them now a number of times. So yes, definitely seeing them in the IMAX cinema is one thing. But even if you just see them on your, you know, when you're at home on a large TV screen, you're always seeing the same film differently. You're always seeing a different film. You just see things in those films every time you watch them. That's the richness. They are jewels that just keep on giving. That's why I do think what we're doing is a very important.
I did want to ask you about the different futures of cinema. And we've got, in Montreal, we have an urban screens project entitled Cité Mémoire, which is 18 film projections throughout heritage buildings in Old Montreal that are telling the so-called story of Montreal in a poetic manner. On the other hand, we have small-scale cinema and mobile cinema, which has been referred to as intimate cinema, as compact cinema, which we're seeing on these little teeny-weeny screens. So we've got the massive urban screens that we move through as we walk through urban space. And then we also walk around with little phones that have screens within screens within screens.
I think you've answered. I think you've answered it. And, André Bazin said that Total Cinema, which, you know, Expo 67, as Donald Thiel has said, was about total cinema. It's about this expansive cinema. But André Bazin said Total Cinema is a kind of myth, and that's what's driving the invention of cinema. And I think that this cinema getting very, very small, cinema getting very large, that is what we're seeing, but also cinema unhinged, you know, cinema that is no longer attached to a human body, no longer attached to an individual, but attached to animals, you know, these tiny little cameras that are attached to eagles that soar all over the place. But also, I mean, look at the images coming back from NASA. Incredible. Just incredible. So we're living through this revolution that I think, you know, didn't necessarily start at Expo, but was certainly expressed by the zeitgeist of Expo 67.
Another page full of themes: man and his world, resources for man and control, ? Another one is called man and his world, progress, and man and his world, habitat 67, which still exists. I don't have stamps for four pavilions, which I also visited, but I have them written down on the back of the passport. The Telephone Pavilion, the Ontario Pavilion, which had a very good movie.
The Ontario Pavilion had a film you could watch, and it was a split-screen film about Ontario, because it was the Ontario Pavilion. And that was new, to see the screen, split screen.
Chris Chapman, shooting film for one of the biggest attractions, a multi-image, ultra-wide screen movie about Ontario.
This has been one of the major jobs, is trying to boil Ontario down to size. We've all found it a very exciting place, a very varied place, and it's been a real backbreaker trying to select all the different subject matter.
Chapman is cutting down the 30 hours of film he's shot to 16 minutes running time on a screen only 5 inches across. At the pavilion, it will be 66 feet across, with as many as 10 images moving across it at one time.
Well, as I say, extremely excited by this technique. The more I delve into it, the more tremendous possibilities it has. As I say, it's another dimension in film. It has such ways of giving people a new, another feeling. It'll be an exciting one because, well, it has unlimited potentials. We do feel that we're onto something that, if used intelligently, can give people something much more exciting than the normal film. You're playing around with colors and squares and blacks and huge images and infinitesimal images that you can move onto any place on the screen. You can imagine sitting in a theater with a 66-foot screen, which, as I understand, is larger than any screen yet in Canada, that takes full advantage of this exciting great tapestry or mural.
Chris Chapman's modern mural is on 70-millimeter film.
Canada, which was vast, and man and his community, or simply community, I don't know. One day, Uncle Gib had other things to do in Montreal, so I met my cousin Brian at the fair. He had trained in from Winnipeg with his friend. Not having a magical uncle along, we actually had to wait in line at the pavilions.
In the dark now, in the corner, knocking for hearts on anyone's door. So I lie here all alone. I imagine no one's out there, nobody cares, not even the phone. So I lie here all alone, 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 alone.
Brian and his friend were more interested in the amusement rides at La Ronde than any of the pavilions. It was there I had the worst pizza I've ever tasted. What sane person puts anchovies on pizzas?
I want an anchovy to go and hold the pizza.
That's stupid. Sorry, pal, you've got the wrong number.
After Montreal, we went down to Ottawa and stayed in the luxurious Chateau Laurier Hotel next to the Parliament buildings. As I was drinking a great cup of tea, Uncle Gib and his wife, my Aunt Lee, who was also very politically involved, pointed out various cabinet ministers in the room, and then the mayor of Montreal, Jean Drapeau, came over to our table to chat with Gib. I still have his card. I then joined up with my cousin Brian and his friend for the long train ride to Winnipeg. In high school, I had played tennis and field hockey. And both sports were on view at the Pan Am Games, which were taking place in Winnipeg at that time. Got a chance to see the great Arthur Ashe in action. Next, I went to the nearby city of Brandon, Manitoba, and spent a couple of days with my cousin Sharon, whose husband was a kind of bureaucrat cowboy. His job was taking care of the Manitoba provincial herd of cattle, and I joined him on horseback moving the cows around. Thankfully, I had gone to an elementary school that featured horseback riding as one of its subjects, so I knew how to do it. But I can't see why anyone would want to. Mostly, I just recall being sore.
Oh, oh boy. These lonely, long highways sure grind the souls off us cowpokes.
From there, I went to my hometown, Yorkton, Saskatchewan. My Aunt Kay and Uncle George had had a fire in their house, so I helped my cousin Howard repaint the smoke-damaged house. Howard had just bought a copy of Sgt. Pepper, which we listened to non-stop while we painted and ate endless chicken pies.
I I'm fixing a hole where the rain gets in and stops my mind from wandering where it will. I'm filling the cracks that ran through the door and kept my mind from wandering where it will go. And it really doesn't matter if I'm wrong, I'm right. Where I belong, I'm right. Where I belong.
Kay was a phenomenal baker, although that's true of most of my aunts. I think my mother was the only member of her large family who never learned to cook. Maybe the rest of her family just chased her out of the kitchen when she tried. Growing up, my father and I were so appalled with her cooking efforts that to stave off starvation, we ate most of our meals in restaurants, or else just grilled endless steaks in the broiler and heated up frozen food. I would be starting Valley State College in September, and was planning to return to Canada for university sometime later. This prompted trips to Regina and Saskatoon to visit their universities. As I was considering a career in radio, I spent some time at the University of Saskatchewan radio station, and still have the brochure they gave me then. 3 years later, I was a student at that university and played Fireside albums on that station. Then back to Calgary, where I caught my flight to LA at the end of August, this time with no life-threatening traffic jams. Back home in Sherman Oaks, I made an audio collage about the trip, though it is long lost. Thankfully, I can remember as much of that trip as I can to make this collage.
This is a little feat song that I did on my